to Resounds, arts and culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. John Tolliver, I'm so glad to have you in the studio. Welcome.
I'm delighted too. Thank you.
John, you have written many books, nonfiction books, about famous American, sometimes heroes, sometimes questionable characters. This is a little bit different for you in terms of taking on a subject that a lot of people don't know about, George Bird Grinnell.
Well, Corby, you're kind of invite me today, and my job, I think, after your kind introduction, is to introduce listeners and readers to this remarkable man, George Bird Grinnell, who has been forgotten, you're right. And yet, over 50 years, he spent several months of every year in Montana and really left his footprints everywhere, from Yellowstone, which is mostly in Wyoming, to what would become Glacier Park on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. The thing I point out in my book is that Montana would be a very different place without George Bird Grinnell, and yet he has been forgotten by Montanans and indeed by much of the American public.
Now, when he died in 1938, though, he was fairly well known. And then I saw that the New York Times said, really, he is the father of American conservationism. What happened between that time and now?
I think the answer is he just did too much. It has been very hard for historians to get their arms around him. He came west as a young man at age 20 out onto the Buffalo Prairies to dig for fossils and to hunt buffalo. He rode into the Black Hills with Custer in 1874. He came into Yellowstone in 1875. He kept coming back every year and really saw what was changing so rapidly in the American West. He brought the sensibilities of an Eastern progressive, the reform impulses that were trying to fix problems in cities and say, look, we have problems in the American West. That led him to do, among other things, found the first Audubon Society with Theodore Roosevelt, create the Boone and Crockett Club, pass the first federal legislation to create migratory bird laws, which were really set the precedent for things like the Endangered Species Act. And on top of all that, he was the preeminent Native American ethnologist of his era. So historians have taken slices of him. For instance, little bighorn buffs like to go into his diaries because he interviewed and walked the battlefield with Indians who had actually fought in the battle. Conservation historians, environmental historians, get at him for other reasons. Mountain climbers, adventurers like his accounts of being the first man to climb all the glaciers in Glacier National Park and name them all. So on and on and on. So it's the answer is George Bird Grinnell is not a minor character. He's been too major a character for history to really keep up with.
So this ethos that he had to study, document, and preserve, he had this, it seems like a dedication and a real compassion to nature, indigenous people, and public land. Where do you think this urgency came from to document all of this?
Well, there's a natural progression. He began as a sportsman. He was a gentleman sportsman, raised in New York, lived on the estate of John James Audubon and on Manhattan Island, was very awakened to the West and to conservation through his connection with the Audubon family. He went west and saw the buffalo disappearing. He came at it as a hunter, but then he realized that the things he was hunting were getting harder to find. That took him to some remote places, including the Rocky Mountain front of what would become Glacier National Park, which is very near the Blackfeet Reservation. Here's the connection. He sees the extinction of species. Darwin has published Origin of the Species in 1859, which is all about evolution and extinction. Grinnell sees this in play in the American West with wildlife. Then very quickly, he gets his exposure to Native Americans for the first time. The Pawnee Indians, the Blackfeet, the Cheyenne, he sees another extinction going on in front of his eyes. So it was all one big ball of wax to him, and it led him to becoming an activist on all fronts, advocating for public lands, national parks, preservation of wild and protection of wildlife, and advocating on behalf of Native Americans.
Did he and Teddy Roosevelt see eye to eye? I mean, people give Teddy Roosevelt a lot of credit for creating national parks and preserving nature. Were they in the same boat?
Definitely in the same boat, probably different positions, pulling slightly different oars. It's an interesting story. Grinnell was born in 1849. Roosevelt was born, I think, 10 years later. Roosevelt had gone west, you'll recall, and had a ranch in Dakota Territory and started hunting and really sort of becoming that Western man then. He wrote a book, Hunting Tales of a Ranchman. It was reviewed by Grinnell, and Grinnell kind of pooh-poohed questioned some of the authenticity, some of the facts in it, because Grinnell regarded himself as an old Western hand at that point. Roosevelt came storming into Grinnell's office. Grinnell was the editor then of a sportsman's journal called Forest and Stream, and said, "What do you mean critiquing my book?" And once they sorted out their differences, they became fast friends, and they became like-minded in their views on conservation. And very soon after that, in 1886, they came up with the idea for the Boone and Crockett Club, which was a group for gentlemen hunters, big game hunters. But
wealthy gentlemen hunters.
Right. But over the years, they kept edging it to become organization for the protection of the wild game that they wanted to hunt.
You describe in the book that Grinnell grew up at a time when most Americans knew little about the sprawling continent beyond their own horizon. So he's definitely got this pioneer spirit to head west and really be part of that movement.
Well, most people come west typically think, gosh, if I'd only gotten here a little sooner. And Grinnell was no exception. He came west in 1870 to dig fossils and understood the great extinction that had occurred in this country. 2 years later, he came back to hunt buffalo, one of the last great buffalo hunts with the Pawnee Indians. And then he had the bug, and he kept finding ways to come back almost every year. He commuted, if you will. The Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1869, so for the very first time, an Eastern person could come west and go back and forth. After visiting Yellowstone a few times and seeing how special that was and seeing what the idea of a national park meant, he was looking for a new place to go, and one of his writers at Forest and Stream said, "Well, come on up to where I live with the Blackfeet." This was a writer well known to many Montanan readers called James Willard Schultz. And he first went up into that country, the St. Mary's Lakes, what he called the Walden Lakes, in 1885. And he was smitten all over again. When he climbed up into the mountains, he believed he was the first white man to set foot on all those glaciers. And he thought, my God, there is still some virgin land left in North America. That same urge that so many adventurers and explorers have had. What's in something new and fresh and untrod? And Grinnell finally had his special place.
But it's interesting to me, and I've read a lot about the railroad and Jay Cook and building the railroad. And 1776, and then it's 1876, 100 years later, we're celebrating, you know, America, and Custer is defeated at Little Bighorn. And people were shocked. What was his thought about that?
Well, first, the most important thing is Grinnell always came down on the side of Native Americans. You can say that he was patronizing or that he subscribed to the conventional scientific wisdom of a hierarchy of races. To a certain extent, he's guilty of that. But he always advocated on behalf of Native Americans. He met Custer up close and personal in 1874 and thought he was a buffoon, that he was kind of a stuffed shirt. He traveled with Custer for 2 months through the Black Hills, and familiarity bred contempt. So when it came back around to Grinnell wanting to write about the Cheyenne Indians and advocate for their well-being, it was fueled to a certain extent by his healthy cynicism towards Custer and realizing just how the 7th Cavalry and Custer had really stirred up the beehive and violated the treaty rights of the Northern Cheyennes and the Sioux, who eventually trounced Custer. Grinnell walked the battlefield several times with Native Americans who fought at the Little Bighorn and was one of the very first guys to get the real blow-by-blow from the Native American perspective.
Hearing you talk, John, it makes me think about this self-described jigsaw puzzle that you put together. I mean, you had 40,000 pages of notes and correspondence, 50 diaries and notebooks, 35 years of Forest and Stream publications. I mean, 50 years of his personal correspondence. How long did it take you to put all this together? It's so exacting in your approach, and there's so much here to digest.
It's a biographer's dream, really. And even if George Bird Grinnell wasn't such a hadn't accomplished so much, he hadn't his deeds weren't so vast and important, it would have been a fascinating study, because when somebody leaves behind 40,000 pages of letters and 50 years of diaries, I mean, these leather-bound books with his scribbled notes of interviewing in the 1890s, interviewing a young Blackfeet who was present when Meriwether Lewis shot the Blackfeet Sidehill calf in 1806. Grinnell has in his notebooks that event. So it is a dream, but it was also a task. And I really felt that I needed to do justice to George Bird Grinnell and to this material. It took me every minute of 6 years.
Wow.
And where are the archives? Are they all over, or is there one primary source?
It's a great story of technology. He sort of ran his life when he wasn't out rambling around Montana from an office in New York, the Forest and Stream office, where he put out a weekly journal where he wrote many of his books. He wrote several hundreds of articles and several dozen books. And he dictated most of his correspondence. There was sort of an early version of a carbon copy that was kept, and they were bound in these notebooks. When it got to 1,000 pages, then they'd start a new notebook. So there are these smudgy notebooks. And his widow, who outlived him by 30 years, gave all these notebooks first to the Connecticut Audubon Society, and then ultimately they went to Yale. So there they lay. Marvelously and fortunately, a microfilm set of these all wound up at the University of Montana Library, where I was fortunate to find them. And even better, just as I came onto the scene, a technology became available. You could scan a reel of microfilm, digitize it in a very quick amount of time. So all of a sudden, I had 40,000 pages of this man's letter on my laptop at home. No one had had that access until I came along.
Completing a portrait of someone after they've passed is incredibly difficult, even with all this material. Are there things that you regret that you didn't have access to?
Well, you always want what you don't have, and you can only build the dinosaur for the bones you dig up. And Grinnell, of course, started his career digging for dinosaur bones, so it's a metaphor, but just barely. This is a history of the conservation movement as told through George Bird Grinnell. But it's also a biography of a man. And a biography is its own genre, I feel. And it's sort of like casting a sculpture. You get the external events in a person's life. And I had all of that. I knew where he was almost every day of his life. But what you really want is to find the inner person. And what is the inner person is, what does the person think of themselves? What is their self-knowledge? So I don't have letters he wrote to his wife, because he was home with her most of the time. And her letters to him do not survive. And I do not have much correspondence between him and another person in his life, a man named George Gould, who I believe was Grinnell's lover. You say you build the dinosaur with the bones you dig up. But for a few bones, you could build a completely different dinosaur. Mm. I see enough clues to George Bird Grinnell in his letters, teasing it out, because his letters were dictated in an office to a stenographer. He had to be careful about what he said. But I found a note of wistfulness in his writing, not just for the disappearance and the loss of the purity of the American West, but of the loss of an opportunity in his life, or some sort of inhibition that he was not able to fulfill. I couldn't get the full dimension of that, but I think it really speaks to what I was talking about earlier, this duality to his life, East and West. He was one person in the East, where he was respected as a Western man, and in the West he was a man of great medicine in the East. And there were two parts of his life, and he liked it that way. And some of it was probably secret too, and I wish I'd gotten more of that.
I think this book is so timely, considering what's happening with our government and the lack of support for national parks or wildlife or wilderness.
Science.
And I kept thinking, I was just in Peru, and our guide, who had been a guide for 30 years, talked about how the Andes were slowly disappearing. The glaciers in the Andes were gone. And I immediately thought, oh my God, what would Grinnell think of Glacier Park if he saw it now? I mean, he was worried about it 150 years ago.
Well, he saw the glaciers melting in 1890 and in 1927, which was his last visit. Everything Grinnell said and thought during his life, and during his life in the West, which was really from 1870 through to the 1920s, applies today. And if I may, I'd like to just read a couple of pull a couple of paragraphs from the book.
Please.
And you tell me how these fit. So Grinnell, as I said, came into Yellowstone for the first time in 1875. And it was the Yellowstone Park. It was the national park. There were no others. And so he saw this germ for other parks. He saw what a national park could be. And he spent the rest of his life developing that germ and coaxing it and working through connections in the East to help create other national parks and ultimately the National Park Service. Here's what he wrote when Yellowstone was being threatened by the railroads. In 1892, they wanted to cut out the whole Lamar Valley, the northern part of the park, and remove it actually from the park. And this is what he said in an editorial. The national park is founded on sentiment. It is a legislative recognition of the existence and human nature of something higher than the sordid love of gain, than the mere question of dollars and cents. To all that class who unblushingly place their little interest above a great public interest, who without scruple would inaugurate measures which would lead to the ruin of the national park, Congress should oppose but one answer, and that should be written in distinct and permanent characters on every border of the park. Thus far thou shalt come, and no further. You think of the public lands debate today, and it's the same fight.
You know, even as early as 1875, you talk about his correspondence really foreshadowing this loss, a lot of rage over the loss of wildlife and the, quote, rude hand of man.
Well, there was a lot of idealism he brought with him. The progressive movement in the East and on the coast was a powerful force. Teddy Roosevelt really caught the wave and really led the wave in a lot of ways. But this urge to fix our problems, urbanization, corruption, the issues of pollution even. And so Grinnell was very much part of that community, and he brought it to bear with nature. And it was very vivid in front of him, this extinction, this destruction, this whittling down of our natural resources was so evident to him that he took it on as a cause and formed it in the same terms as some of the causes in, you know, fixing urban problems.
I keep thinking about the railroads, the expansion at this time of all the money and the push to bring people out to the West, whether it's for mining or gold, but all pushed by the railroads. And here's a man trying to save parts of that land from that manifest destiny of Eastern expansion into the West.
But it couldn't be done without the railroads. We would have no national parks without the railroads. Think about what the Santa Fe Railroad did for the Grand Canyon, what James J. Hill and the Northern Pacific did for Glacier. National parks are well protected in most cases, and Grinnell was very much a part of that. But they're not necessarily wilderness. They are the original charter for Yellowstone was a pleasuring ground. That's a tug of war. That's an irony that we will have to live with and find a balance going forward.
You had to be very wealthy to go see Yellowstone Park until the beginning of the railroad that people could actually go there.
Yeah, that's true. Train travel was expensive, and it's still expensive. It's still expensive to go to a national park, fill your car full of gas to get out there, and yet people want to go. They realize that it's less. It's the thing you do. You owe your children. How was that created? Well, get back to my guy, Grinnell. He very much recognized early on just how important that is. So here is Grinnell writing to one of his dear friends, a guy he mentored named Charles Sheldon, again about just the importance of the national parks. He's writing in 1920, at which point there is a National Park Service, and there are many more national parks than back when he first visited Yellowstone, and there was only one park. Anyway, Grinnell writes, "I believe that the parks are actually producers of wealth because they enable the people who visit them to work through the rest of the year harder, longer, and better than they would work if they had not had the change of thought and received the mental stimulus that they got from those novel surroundings and this contact with nature. I believe that the sum of all this better work done by the people who visit the parks is worth more than all the water, all the power, and all the timber that they contain."
Yes. Romantic.
Well, and you know, you describe his writing as conducted with ease and accessibility. And I'm curious how that might have factored into your writing process, because I feel like, you know, the book that you've written has that same feeling.
Well, I've always said that all biography is autobiography. You go through 40,000 pages of a person's letters. You, like driving down the road, you see what sticks to your windshield. And in the case of Grinnell, a lot, it was his writing. A writer writing about a writer is a wonderful dance. And if you live with a person's writing, you do absorb it and you do admire it. It's what we have behind. So in some sense, you don't want to upstage it. You want to pick the best of it, give it its due, put it in the proper context. So I tried not to get in the way of Grinnell's writing. I tried not to, if he was writing floridly or metaphorically, I left out florid language and metaphor and let all that belong to him. As I say, it's a biography. It's the story of a man's life, and it begins with his birth and then ends at his death. And along the way, you want to freight that life that narrative, that biographical narrative, with the knowledge of his context, his impact, the people who influenced him, his friends, whom he influenced. And it is a delicate balance. And we read many biographies where there is not enough of either one, and the wheels get out of balance, or they wear you down as a reader. I really take it as my task and responsibility is to have just the right amount of knowledge and the right amount of narrative. And Grinnell was perfect for that.
The way that he described and documented what was going on with the indigenous cultures of the land that he was on. I mean, there's a lot there that you were able to transcribe and bring back to light.
Well, Grinnell, as progressive as he was as a conservationist and as out front as he was, the so-called father of American conservationists, he was almost radical in his advocacy of Native Americans. Racism was everywhere in the United States, as it still is, and not just towards African Americans, not just towards immigrants, but back then towards Native Americans. They'd been pushed onto reservations. There were early groups advocating on their behalf, but Grinnell was one of the more strident and consistent protectors. And he had a lot of influential friends in New York and Washington, and he would go at his own expense to Washington and advocate specifically for two tribes, the Blackfeet of Montana and the Cheyennes. The Cheyennes had the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in eastern Montana and the Southern Cheyenne Reservation in Oklahoma. He ended up writing big benchmark books on the Cheyenne and the Blackfeet. But more than that, he lobbied to get rid of bad agents, to fight for better rations, for their respect. He was adopted into the Blackfeet tribe. He was beloved by the Cheyennes. He had many, many friends. And a lot of his friends in the East weren't ready to buy into that. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt, for all of his great gifts and deeds as a conservationist, was very much anti-Native American. And for instance, it was Roosevelt who said, playing off a remark given by General Philip Sheridan, Roosevelt said, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely in the case of the 10th. Now this,
wow.
He wrote when he was the governor of New York. He believed that the white race, that the English-speaking race, deserved to prevail, manifest destiny. Now, Grinnell got along with Roosevelt in conservation, but he butted heads with him in terms of Native American issues. And I think Grinnell's work with Native Americans has been overshadowed by his work as a conservationist. And that's too bad, because he had great impact there also.
Grinnell, America's environmental pioneer, and his restless drive to save the West. It's out now, and it is a really important read. Thank you, John Tolliver, for being in the studio with us.
Delighted to be here.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.